You're listening to WRBB News on WRBB 104.9 FM Boston. This show is a collaboration between us, the radio station, and the Huntington News Northeastern University student newspaper. I'm Bella and...
I'm Grace.
And we're the co-hosts for the show. Today we have a couple of Hunt News reporters in to talk about their stories. The first is Aaron Fine, here to talk about Northeastern University's research team's participation on a Boston task force to investigate the impact of slavery in Boston and to what extent reparations can be enacted. Aaron, if you could just give us a brief introduction to your story before we launch into the questions.
Yeah, of course. So I just wanted to start out by saying that this is a Black story. It deeply concerns the history and the community of Black people in Boston, and that I'm working just to elevate this story, you know, as much as I can as a student journalist here, and that I want the focus to be on the Black community of Boston. So what's happened here is that the Boston Task Force on Reparations has recruited two research teams, one from Tufts, one from Northeastern, regarding Boston's history and legacy of slavery. The Northeastern team is focusing on 1940s to the present. So my article was kind of going into the areas that they'll be focusing on, how the legacy of slavery didn't just end when slavery ended, how it's still very much impactful today, and what that looks like. So we're just at the beginning of that research, so you know, excited to see where that comes out and what the implications of that for, you know, the city are.
And could you talk a little bit about how and why Boston's mayor, Michelle Wu, announced this project in the first place?
Well, it was announced late last year, that they were, you know, looking for research teams to work with the Boston Task Force on Reparations to study the 1600s to the present, just the sort of impact, the legacy of slavery in Boston, because it's something that's not really covered or known about. I think because Boston's a northern city, you know, in a very liberal blue state nowadays, we don't really think about what slavery was like. There's an image in to a lot of people that slavery was southern plantations, which isn't inaccurate, but there was definitely a great northern impact on slavery in Boston. That kind of appeared in things like shipyards and distilleries. So these teams were built to sort of study that, you know, less known history. And
who is on the Northeastern University team?
Yeah, so it's a decently sized team. The leaders are Margaret Burnham. She's a university's distinguished professor of law, and she's the director of the Civil Rights and Restorative Justice Project. And Deborah Jackson, she's the managing director of the Center for Law, Equity, and Race. That's Racial Justice Center at Northeastern.
And do you know what the work is going to look like for them? I know it says that the team will examine the legacy of slavery after 1940. Like, what does that look like? Are they going over documents and stuff? Are they conducting interviews? And I think they said it was a $500,000 budget and things like that. So just like, do we know anything about like what the day-to-day workload of this project is going to look like?
Well, it's still in its early stages, and unfortunately I didn't get too much information on that, but it is going to be, you know, a very widespread look. It's going to be documents, it's going to be, you know, oral histories taken from all sorts of places about the impact of slavery.
And the task force is made up of both Northeastern and Tufts teams, right?
Yeah, so there's two task forces, and one is Tufts and also working with the Royal House and Slave Quarters and the African American Trail Project. That's a very interesting, knowledgeable group of people there that I don't know as much about. But so the Northeastern team is, you know, it's academics, it's professors, there's community leaders, there's... you know, are also a really interesting group of people that are going to bring a really interesting look at what, you know, this legacy is.
Yeah, reading here, it's kind of interesting. It says that Tufts team is going to study Boston's participation and legacy in the slave trade from 1620 to 1940, which is a pretty big chunk of time. And then Northeastern's team is going to be from 1940 to today. So it's kind of interesting how they broke that up with like the 300-year stretch towards the last 80 years. Like, do you know anything about that decision making, or is it just, you know, like up to them how they did it?
Yeah, so there were several areas of study. I think there were six is about the number, you know, but like broken up pieces of time. And I don't know what the selection was for that, but I assume these groups applied to just these different periods of time, and they decided that, you know, this one group wanted to work on that longer period of time, and one group wanted to focus on, you know, the 1940s to today.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. And so the teams will produce detailed reports that will be used to outline reparations programs in Boston. So I'm honestly not familiar with reparations as a concept. I mean, of course, I know what it is, which is like, I guess, financial remuneration and stuff for, you know, descendants of slavery and things like that. So is it the research team's job just to like measure the extent, or are they specifically, as it that seems to suggest, like equipped to give recommendations, you know, on what these policies look like?
You know, it's going to be everything. It's it is going to be, you know, researching who exactly was affected and how, you know, what that legacy looks like. And they will be making recommendations in the report, I believe. There will be, you know, the financial aspect is definitely the first thought of, but there's potentially exploring other options like, you know, community investment, you know, education funds, just different sort of, all different kinds of reparations that could come out of this.
And this is not super related. What was the vibe like at that task force meeting? Did you go there in person?
I was on Zoom because I was very sick.
And what was the atmosphere like? You know, were they just kind of announcing what was going to go down? Like, you know, was there any community feedback going on, I guess?
Yeah, it was. It was the announcement. The task force talked about, you know, why they were doing this project. The leaders of the task force came up and kind of explained what they were focusing on. And there was a lot of community comment. People were very concerned that this should be done, you know, openly. The process should be very transparent, that exactly what's getting funded and why should be very open for the public to see. And that, you know, people were very concerned about where these funds are going. And it was definitely a very, you know, impassioned discussion about that this should be done right.
Do you remember off the top of your head any points that like specifically that they made? No worries if you don't,
because vaguely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was people were concerned about, like, one was concerned that the funds should go to the families of former slaves. Mm-hmm. Specifically, rather than a sort of blanket fund, which you know, seemed to be a point of contention. Lots of different opinions on that. You know, people were concerned that the funds would be, you know, actually appropriated to the right areas. It was definitely lots of concerns about transparency and then also just responsible funding.
Yeah, it seems like, I don't know. I mean, of course, Boston is generally a liberal city, and so is Michelle Wu and her administration. But reparations kind of tend to be a controversial subject. It's one of those kind of polarized things. So yeah, it really wouldn't surprise me if people were really worried about having it done right, you know, because Boston's a major city, you make a misstep or you, like, I don't know, waste the money, or like there's some kind of backlash against it. That would probably be a national thing. But that's just me pontificating. Grace, you have anything to add?
I think to follow up on the transparency thing, since it is like relatively new, do you think transparency could be an issue in the future, especially because they seem to be taking on like a lot of things? It doesn't seem the most like concentrated. It's pretty spread out. So do you think as they like continue to work on this, transparency could be an issue?
I feel like it certainly could, like any sort of government, you know, venture. Transparency can become an issue, you know, if these reports come out with not much information on how they were done, or potentially it's the funds are just allocated behind the scenes. I feel like there's definitely room for concern there. A lot of the people that were concerned were in full support of, you know, reparations, but they wanted to make sure it was done right, that what it was doing for the Black community of Boston was an actual solution and not sort of a Band-Aid or just saying we've done something.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think sticks out to me the most, is making sure they're actually doing things and it's not really just like a, we're working on this and we're acknowledging that this exists, but we're actually like
getting it done.
Yeah, I'm like struggling to find the words, but yeah, like actually doing it effectively.
Do we have any sense of what the timeline in this project is going to look like? It began requesting research proposals in late 2023, it being the task force. But to my knowledge, like honestly, a few months is a pretty decent timeline. Like with big projects like this that involve a bunch of different organizations, city funds especially, blah, blah, blah. And I guess, do you think that this project is going to work at this kind of quick pace in the similar way? Or could this stretch on for like 5 years or however long?
I think that's a bit long of a timeline there, but you know, I don't have much of an idea of a timeline personally. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to talk with a research team member about that specifically. Mm-hmm. I really wish I had, because I think a lot of people would be interested in what the timeline of this would be, because there is definitely concern that when it comes to bureaucracy, that things can just drag on and, you know, people forget. But I think that's something people are definitely interested in, but unfortunately, I don't have the answers.
Mm-hmm. Are you generally interested in social justice coverage like this as a reporter?
I am. It's something I definitely focus on. I've done a lot of protest rally coverage on multiple things throughout my time at the Huntington News. Mm-hmm. I just feel like it's really important to cover what people care about, what moves people, and what people feel is important enough to get out and really try to make a change about, you know, whatever my opinions are on it. I want, you know, their stories to be out there.
Yeah, I think it's good that Hunt News does this kind of, you know, more rote, shall we say, like city coverage. Like, I think that this sort of reporting where you just go to city council meetings or to court hearings or whatever is increasingly being eroded, not to get in my soapbox about like the industry. But like, you know, it's good to have like just like on the ground or on the Zoom local journalism happening. So I don't know. I think you guys did a great job with this piece.
No, you have a point. That you know, would go to beat reporters, which are just, you know, kind of, as journalism evolves, you know, that kind of area is sort of degrading. But, you know, the people that could just sit in on, you know, city council meetings and all these things, you know, people don't realize how important that is. But when you think of journalism as, you know, the watchdog for government, especially local government, because who else is monitoring the inner workings of, you know, all these city councils and mayor's offices, that is really important.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you so much for coming in, Grace.
Thank you.
Do you have any last points?
I don't think so. I like what you guys are saying about, I do think it's really important to have coverage like this. Thank you so much, Erin.
Yeah, well, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
And now we have Lily Cooper in the studio here to talk about a Northeastern PhD student's discovery of some previously unknown Louisa May Alcott stories. For those of you who don't know who Louisa May Alcott is, she is the author of Little Women, among other works. But yeah, if Lily, if you could give like a brief rundown of the story before we launch into the questions.
Yeah, sure. So basically, as you said, it's a story about this Northeastern postdoc professor who, as he was doing research for his PhD, he kind of like stumbled upon this story called The Phantom by Louisa May Alcott, well, by E.H. Gould. And he was searching for works by Louisa May Alcott, but when he originally saw the title and the author, he thought, oh, well, obviously that's not her. This isn't Alcott or an Alcott pseudonym. And he kind of set it aside. And then after thinking for a bit, he came back to it and thought, what if it is Alcott? What if this is a new Alcott pseudonym? And that kind of led him down a road of discovering all these other works by Gould. And I think there's around 20 in all that he's uncovered. Some of them are by Gould, some of them assigned Alcott, some of them are under a pseudonym we knew about called Flora Fairfield. And yeah, it's just all about his discovery and the work that he's doing.
Yeah, so could you talk a little bit more about how he discovered it was Louisa May Alcott and kind of what that discovery means, I guess, to the Alcott community.
Yeah, of course. So he actually came across a reference to the Phantom in one of Louisa May Alcott's journals. So that's what initially led him to looking for the title of the Phantom. And then as for the story itself and what kind of made him think that it could be Alcott's, it's sort of like, he calls it like a fan fiction of Charles Dickens, A Christmas Carol. And Alcott was like, she was a big fan of Dickens, so it makes sense that she would write something like that. As for what it means for, I guess, the like, yeah, Louisa May Alcott fans, I spoke to Gregory Iseline, I think. I'm sorry if I'm butchering his name, but yeah, he's the president of the Louisa May Alcott Society. And he's just, they're all super excited about it. Obviously, it's the first time a discovery like this has been made since, I think, the 1940s. So it's a pretty big deal. And yeah, they're excited about the fact that other people are excited, because it shows that there's still a lot of Louisa May Alcott fans out there, and she's still very relevant in our culture today. So yeah.
I probably should have mentioned the PhD candidate's actual name. His name is Max Chapnick. Just out of curiosity, do we know what his realm of study is in the first place? Is it specifically Louisa May Alcott? Is it like female authors in the 19th century? Do we know?
No. So his actual field of study, it's a little bit, well, it seems unrelated. It's kind of pseudoscience and the supernatural in stories, that kind of thing in literature. And the reason that he was drawn to Louisa May Alcott is before Little Women, there was this period of time where she was writing a lot of sort of gothic thrillers, more dark and, yeah, supernatural, hence The Phantom. So that was what initially drew him to Alcott, I guess, yeah.
Why would Louisa May Alcott use a pseudonym in the first place? Could you explain?
Yeah, so that's kind of the big question of the article, is why was she doing this? It's not like these works are terrible, and it's not like she would have been completely ostracized for writing something like this, but it definitely is to do with the public opinion of women writers at the time, and kind of this view that women maybe couldn't write about these more salacious topics about like murder and drug use and all that kind of thing. So I think she was trying to kind of protect her image and protect her career in a way. I think that's one reason why she did it. There's kind of, some people think that it's because of her family. She wasn't trying to reflect badly on her family in any way. But yeah, I think it's the genre change that is the main thing. She's writing outside of her typical genre, and she doesn't want that to affect her career when she's writing more, I guess, typical things for women of the time to write, like the novel Little Women.
And these are earlier works, right? Like before she published this, while she was starting out?
Yeah, exactly. It's around sort of a decade or two before Little Women, yeah.
And then you said that some of the work was under like a pseudonym that was already known, right? So did she have multiple pseudonyms, and were they for like different genres?
I don't know if they were for different genres specifically. That would be an interesting thing to look into. But yeah, she definitely had multiple pseudonyms. There's, yeah, Flora Fairfield, this new possible one, E.H. Gould. Sometimes she would just sign things as her initials or her last name. There's another pseudonym. It's in the article. I can't think of it off the top of my head right now. But yeah, she definitely had multiple different names that she was using at the time.
And it's interesting, in the article, you guys take pains to point out that, you know, there's a lot of evidence, you know, leaning this way, mm-hmm. probably it is, but, you know, you stop short of saying for sure that it is Louisa May Alcott's work, because, you know, we don't know for sure. So I guess, what kind of evidence would, like, really prove dead to rights that it is the work and settle the question?
I guess there's no real way to prove 100% that it's mm-hmm. her. Obviously she can't tell us, and unless we were to find kind of, one example would be like if there was a letter from a publisher thanking her for a story that shared the name of one of the stories that Max has discovered, but we don't have anything like that, and that's probably unlikely to be found. One thing that could provide more solid evidence is the work that Max is doing at the I don't know if it's NU Lab or New
yes,
Lab.
I think
and that's like stylometry, so comparing known Alcott text to these new ones that he's discovered, and it's kind of like you run it through an algorithm and it tells you, it looks at frequency of word use. And I don't really know the specific techniques, to be honest. Sarah O'Connell, she works at the New Lab. I spoke to her and she says that it's more complex than just looking at like how often a word is used. There's like an actual algorithm built that will tell you these things. So I guess that would be better evidence than just the reference to the Phantom in her journal and like some of the things in the stories that have been picked up. But there's no way to tell 100%, I would say.
And it's interesting because reading more closely, the head of the president of the Louisa May Alcott Society, Gregory Iseline, said that most of, to his eye, most of the E.M. Gold, the pseudonym stories, seem legit, but he specifically says that one of them is too preachy and doesn't resemble the writing style. I guess I'm a little confused about how that would work if he is right. Like, did Louisa May Alcott like write half these stories under this pseudonym when someone was like, can I borrow that pen name? And then, you know what I mean? I guess, is that like a likely thing, or is it more like kind of all or nothing, I guess?
I would say it's probably all or nothing. I think the one that you're referring to wasn't actually under E.H. Gould. I think signed like Alcott. Yeah, sorry if that's not clear in the article. We should go back and make that clear. Yeah, I think it was just written as Alcott, and that's why he thinks that maybe it was written by her uncle, William Alcott. Okay. Yeah, I would need to double check that for sure, but definitely that would kind of be misleading if some of the Gould stories looked like they were hers and some of them didn't, because I would agree with you. I think it would be like either they're all hers or they're nothing to do with her at all. So, yeah.
And there's supposed to be like a bunch of different pseudonyms that we haven't found yet, right? Because it says like in her journal, or I'm not sure if that was one of the background articles I read, that in her journal, like she had like a bunch of unattributed stories that we haven't found like the sources for yet.
Yeah, Max says that there's like lists and lists of stories that she's supposedly written, and within the lists are stories that we do know about. So it's like, it's not like these are just ideas. They are, at least some of them, are things that she wrote. And then sometimes she'll write a list of all the things that made her the most money in a certain year, and within that will be stories that we've never heard of or never seen attributed to her name. So Max at least definitely thinks that there are more out there, but whether they're findable is the question, whether they're have kind of been lost to time. There's no digital record of them anywhere, or no digital record of the publications that they're in. But yeah, these kind of lists of tons of different stories certainly lead us to think that there are more. Yeah.
This is kind of circling back a little bit. Do you think, it says that he is hoping to publish his findings soon, do you think there is a little bit of hesitancy perhaps, like for having like misinterpreted something, or his findings are actually not like Louisa May Alcott's? I don't know how likely that is, but just hesitancy of like getting something wrong, I guess.
I think so, yeah. I think he definitely is willing to publish either way. Yeah. And Max is more focused on doing the work and doing it well and coming to the correct conclusion rather than like trying to prove that the stories are Alcott's necessarily. So he wants to publish either way, and he thinks that he'd be doing people a disservice if he found some evidence that pointed towards the fact that they weren't hers and then he didn't come out and say that. So I think in his mind, at least, the main thing about doing it right would be to just like get the truth out. And even if the truth is that these stories weren't written by her or can't be officially linked to her, he just wants to make sure that people have all the information.
Yeah, it'll be an interesting case study, like either way, if the process is documented and you can just kind of, I guess, use that as a test case or whatever. I guess my last question is this kind of work typical of Northeastern PhD programs at all? Because I was kind of surprised. I mean, I thought of this would be something you would find at like a liberal arts college or something. So for it to happen at Northeastern kind of surprised me a little.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'd never heard of anything like this being done at Northeastern before. I don't really know if it's typical. I'm a STEM major, so I kind of thought of Northeastern as like a STEM school, and like obviously people are humanities majors, but I didn't realize that there was kind of this depth of work being done, especially at the PhD level.
So honestly, I don't know. But it clearly does go on. And the NU lab is all about social sciences and the humanities. So they're dedicated to this kind of work. And when I spoke to Sarah O'Connell, she was telling me about a lot of the other projects she's doing about kind of literature analysis. And she was saying that stylometry is just one of the techniques that we use here at Northeastern. So I think there is a lot of this work being done. Maybe it's not like publicized as widely as some of the STEM work that Northeastern does for whatever reason. But yeah, I think this story is just one small part of a lot of like social sciences, humanities research that goes on.
And do you have a specific interest in Louisa May Alcott? Because when I was talking to Eli, the editor-in-chief of Hunt News, about this, I think he said that you were like pretty hyped about this story.
I was really excited about it. I wouldn't call myself like a major Louisa May Alcott fan. I'm probably like the same as everybody else. Like I've read The Women, I've seen the movie. I love Timothée Chalamet. Like, I don't know. I didn't have like a specific special interest in her, but I just thought it was really cool because of like the unknown and the mystery surrounding the story. I found that really interesting. And now after writing it, I have a list of titles of hers that have been recommended to me to read, so I'll definitely be checking those out. But yeah, it's been really fun to write, and I definitely know a lot more about her now than I did to begin with. Yeah.
All right, thank you so much for coming in. Grace, do you have any questions you want to throw in?
No, but I think that what you're saying about it, it does kind of read like a murder, not a murder, a mystery case. And I think that if he publishes this work, even it as like kind of like uncovering this mystery is super interesting. So this was really cool to hear about. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Great, thank you guys.